From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Newt Gingrich admits he violated House ethics rules. Republicans defend him while some Democrats go on the attack.
What the Speaker did, he took charitable organizations like the Abraham Lincoln Foundation, which was supposed to help needy kids, poor kids in the inner city, and he'd used that money to funnel that money out of that organization back to his own political empire.
Citizens respond to hate crimes around the country by saying, not in our town.
When a Native American family's home was defaced with racist graffiti, 30 members of the Painters Union showed up to paint over.
So many of the times, the cause and I end up standing on the sidelines too much. I feel something, but I never really did a lot to do anything about anything. And I was really glad to help paint the house, and more so, to help convey a message to these guys that the community will not stand for that.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Tupac Amaru guerrillas occupying the residence of the Japanese ambassador in Peru released 225 of their 365 hostages last night. But they stopped short of fulfilling President Alberto Fujimori's demand that they release all their captives and lay down their arms in exchange for the chance of free passage out of the compound. The guerrillas did not release their most strategically important captives, including ambassadors of several Latin American countries, five Peruvian generals, two Peruvian cabinet members, and scores of Japanese and Peruvian businessmen. While the move appeared conciliatory, it also eased the way for the 20 guerrillas to control the hostages remaining. The Red Cross negotiator said just over 140 people were still held. Well known for his strong-arm tactics, the Peruvian President Fujimori in his speech refused to give in to Tupac Amaru's demands that he free more than 400 of their jailed comrades. The rebel group, which threatened to kill the hostages if the government does not release jailed comrades, has no immediate response to Fujimori's proposal. One of the latest hostages released in Lima, Peru, says political debates with his rebel captors lasted for hours, and he says it was interesting to hear their point of view. But 140 other hostages, remain in the Japanese ambassador's home. There's still little official information about an apparently deadly explosion near Houston, Texas. Local broadcast reports say at least five people are dead following the blast at the Wyman Gordon Forging Company, a defense contractor. Outside the plant, a white sign with black letters says, "A work injury can put you and your family in a heck of a fix. Don't get injured," in 1996. This news from the front page of the Washington Post, CIA Inspector General Frederick P. Hitz has reopened an investigation into the failure of agency clandestine officers to report allegations of torture by a CIA-supported Honduran military intelligence unit in the mid-1980s. This according to agency officials and congressional sources. The inquiry, which was dropped earlier this year but resumed under pressure from the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, raises the possibility of a new round of reprimands or disciplinary actions against active and retired officers for conduct in Central America. Last year, two senior CIA clandestine officers were fired and eight active or former operatives reprimanded for involvement with a Guatemalan army colonel linked to abuses. In a separate development, it has been learned that CIA medals were awarded in September and earlier this month to three former top clandestine service officials, each of whom had been disciplined or pushed into retirement in the past 2 years after reprimands or inspector general inquiries. And Congressmember John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan, the leading Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, has joined with committee chair Henry Hyde in asking the attorney general to investigate charges of irregularities regarding the recent Teamsters election. Conyers said he's been personally approached by several union members about the election and that the, quote, 1.4 million members of the Teamsters Union each need to be assured that their election was conducted without taint or corruption. They went on to say the public must be satisfied that this was a completely fair election. And you're listening to Democracy Now! 'Twas the week before Christmas and all through the House. Not a speaker was stirring, but everyone else was talking about ethics and Gingrich's plight. Should Newt be forgiven or go the way of Jim Wright? A House Ethics Subcommittee on Saturday found that Speaker Gingrich brought discredit to the House by using tax-exempt money for political purposes and providing the committee with, quote, inaccurate, incomplete, and unreliable information about the role of a political action committee in a college course he taught. The full Committee on Standards of Official Conduct must still meet to decide whether to recommend disciplinary action. It's likely to call for some form of censure or reprimand, but not for a penalty so severe as to preclude his reelection as Speaker, such as expulsion. A recommendation could come before 1997. Well, predictably, Republicans in Congress are rallying around Newt Gingrich, insisting that he did not intend to mislead the Ethics Committee about the nature of the course he taught at a Georgia college and its connection to GOPAC, his powerful political action committee. But Democrats aren't buying Newt's mea culpa and claims of naivete. Congressmember John Conyers has issued a statement saying it's time for the GOP to start looking for a new speaker, and it's time for the Justice Department to open an investigation. Democrat Dave Bonier of Michigan is House Minority Whip, the man who's been leading the ethics battle against Newt Gingrich. He held a news conference this weekend along with Bill Paxon, who is a Republican congressmember from New York. First, David Bonier.
The Ethics Committee today has, by a unanimous decision, voted a statement of alleged violations against Speaker Newt Gingrich. This is tantamount to an indictment of the Speaker of the House. Mr. Gingrich, in his own statement, has admitted that he is guilty of the charges. The committee has found that Mr. Gingrich's activities violated U.S. tax laws by using at least four tax-exempt foundations for his own political purposes. These illegal activities not only benefited Mr. Gingrich himself, they benefited his Political Action Committee, GOPAC, and they benefited other Republican entities and candidates. The committee also found that Mr. Gingrich has repeatedly provided them with misleading and inaccurate information. This pattern of deception related to matters that were absolutely central. They were absolutely central to the case. One letter alone, signed by Mr. Gingrich himself, contained at least seven false statements to the Ethics Committee about whether GOPAC was involved with his nonpartisan tax foundation. He lied about the heart of the case. In summary, Mr. Gingrich has been found guilty of violating the rules of the House of Representatives by misusing our tax laws for his own political benefit, and he has repeatedly lied to the Ethics Committee about this. Now, over a period of years, Mr. Gingrich has set up a series of so-called charitable organizations which were really a sham. This was a scheme to allow wealthy contributors to take tax breaks to further Mr. Gingrich's own political career. Then he repeatedly lied to the American people to cover up this tax fraud. Mr. Gingrich has been found guilty today of very serious violations. They go to the heart of our democratic system. He has engaged in a pattern of abuse of our tax laws over a period of 7 years for his own political purposes. And he has repeatedly, unequivocally lied to the Ethics Committee and to the American people about it. The Ethics Committee has found Mr. Gingrich's actions have brought discredit on the House of Representatives. The Gingrich case does not end here. It is inconceivable to me that a person who has been found guilty of such serious violations, included repeatedly lying to the Committee of Congress, could continue as Speaker of the House. There are serious legal problems ahead for the Speaker as well. The allegations laid out by the Ethics Committee raise grave concerns, which I would expect the Justice Department, the FBI, a grand jury, and other appropriate entities to investigate. From the charges in this document, it appears that Mr. Gingrich may have engaged in criminal tax violations. The tax-exempt foundations that he has been associated with and perhaps some of the financial contributors to these foundations may have also violated tax laws. Mr. Gingrich may also have engaged in criminal patterns of obstruction of justice. It is appalling today that some of Mr. Gingrich's defenders would try to minimize the seriousness of these violations. Mr. Gingrich engaged in a pattern of tax fraud, lies and cover-ups and paving his road to the second highest office in the land. He is not worthy of that office. And those who attempt to make excuses for him or for his behavior are doing a grave disservice to this institution and to the American people.
Senator, you said that he benefited himself. The committee indicated he gained nothing material from this. What is the benefit
is
directly to him?
That is not correct. If you turn to page 17 and you'll read the section 38, the bottom paragraph, you will see that the last couple of lines, it says those activities were intended to confer more than insubstantial benefits on Mr. Gingrich, on GOPAC, and other Republican entities and candidates.
What were those benefits?
Those benefits were becoming the Speaker of the House and gaining power in his march to become Speaker of the House. And we yet do not know what benefits he incurred with respect to GOPAC. That needs to be resolved, and that is another question that's out there. He gained benefits with respect to the book deal. The first thing he did as Speaker of the House of Representatives was try to cut a $4.5 million book deal, about $3 million inflated over what the original actual sale of it eventually was. The Speaker has acted in his own political and personal interest for many years leading up to his speakership and since he has been in the speakership.
I'm Bill Paxson. In my final days as chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee and member of the House Republican leadership. And I'd just like to make some opening comments and then be happy to take your questions. First of all, on behalf of the leadership, we are pleased with the hard work and the time put in by the subcommittee. It is clear now that we're nearing the end of this process. We want you to know, as we issued a statement today, the leadership strongly supports and endorses the re-election of Speaker Gingrich. And I've spent today talking with and hearing from rank-and-file members of the House Republican Caucus from across the country, and it's clear that they, too, very, very strongly support the re-election of the Speaker, which will be accomplished on January 7th. Now, you just heard here from David Bonier. And I think it's clear, after listening to his comments today, that his obsession is with this case has caused him to overlook the facts as just laid out by the subcommittee. He repeatedly used the phrases that Newt lied and had committed tax fraud, not once, but over and over again. As a matter of fact, his written statement uses those terms. You don't need a Republican member of the House to stand here to tell you that that just isn't true. You can read the report of the subcommittee. Go to it. The subcommittee did not say that the Speaker lied, as Mr. Bonier just alleged, and the subcommittee did not say that he committed tax fraud, as Mr. Bonier just alleged. As a matter of fact, the subcommittee didn't conduct a trial to draw conclusions. They investigated this case and made a report. He is grossly and inaccurately misrepresenting the work of the subcommittee. And again, it's not surprising. He has done this throughout this process because of his obsession with dethroning the Speaker of this House, removing him. He has not allowed facts to get in the way of his making his case. Moreover, the big lies that he has laid out today in claiming, making these charges, undermine his credibility as a spokesperson in regard to this matter. And I also think he does a tremendous disservice to the hard work of the bipartisan members of the subcommittee. They have spent countless hours over a long period of time thoroughly investigating this matter. They did not reach these conclusions that he is now trying to misrepresent and put those words into the mouths of the subcommittee in the report that they issued. And I think that that is a disservice. Mr. Bonier should be ashamed of himself for making those claims that he knows are inaccurate in his obsessive zeal to attack the Speaker of this House. He also made the kind of bizarre claim that those who are supporting or surrounding the Speaker are somehow also guilty of benefiting in some way in this case. I think that, too, is outrageous, and he deserves to apologize. He should apologize to the members that he is making these allegations about, and I wouldn't be surprised if he's in filing a whole new series of ethics charges because of his obsession with this whole issue. He also mentioned criminal referrals, and let's make it very clear. That report did not make criminal referrals. As a matter of fact, it's ridiculous. If the subcommittee felt that those criminal referrals were warranted, they certainly would have done so, and they certainly would have mentioned that in the report. He once again does a disservice to that subcommittee and again further undermines his credibility. Now, folks, we've had 2 years of partisan warfare using the Ethics Committee process for partisan political gain. I think the action of the subcommittee today moves us toward a conclusion of these ethics claims in regard to the speaker. And I think it would also moves us away from partisan rancor. I also believe that's a reason to tip our hat to the subcommittee. They've put aside partisanship and examined these things in a dispassionate way. And while David Bonier's obsession seems endless, I believe most members, Republicans and Democrats, want to begin the 105th Congress on a more positive note. I would also note, if you haven't seen it, I'd refer you to the statement issued by Representative Christopher Shays today, because many of you have talked to him and quoted him in recent months, as he has examined this issue. And I will just quote his statement issued this afternoon. The subcommittee has issued its finding, and I believe it points to a positive resolution of the case involving the speaker. I look forward to casting my vote on January 7 for Newt Gingrich as Speaker of the House of Representatives.
And there you have it. That was Bill Paxon, Republican of New York. Before that, David Bonier of Michigan, the House Minority Whip. You're listening to Democracy Now! As they respond to the House subcommittee statement on Saturday and their findings on the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. We're now joined by Gary Ruskin, who is director of the Congressional Accountability Project based in Washington, D.C., long a Newt Gingrich watcher following the plaints against him before the Ethics Committee. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Gary.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, why don't we start out? Because one of the things I found from Saturday morning when the statement was released, the findings were released by the House subcommittee, until now, is that very few times in the media did I hear explained exactly what was found against House Speaker Newt Gingrich.
Sure. On December 21st, on Saturday, the investigative subcommittee of the Ethics Committee released a very long, extensive statement of alleged violation, which alleged the following things. First, it documented a series of 13 statements made by the Speaker through counsel to the Ethics Committee that were either false or misleading. 13 statements, not just one, and they weren't just trivial statements. They were statements that went to the core of the matter that the investigative subcommittee was investigating, i.e., whether or not the Speaker had misused 501c3 foundation monies for partisan political purposes, which would be prohibited by federal tax law. So that is the first and most important thing that the investigative subcommittee found in its statement of alleged violation. Then other matters that were somewhat dealt with by the statement of alleged violations were regarding whether or not those 501c3 funds were in fact misused by the Speaker. And on that question, the committee somewhat punted. They didn't say so explicitly that that those violations had, in fact, occurred, but what they did say was that the committee's own tax expert concluded that those violations had, in fact, occurred.
We're going to come back to this conversation in a minute and find out from you who exactly is on this ethics subcommittee. The findings now go to the ethics committee. And we also want to just touch on, because Newt Gingrich is not the only person who's dealing with financial malfeasance. These charges go up to the top, although different kinds of charges, and they go to President Clinton. And we want to touch on that, what you see the House is going to be doing along those lines. But before we do that, we have to go to a break. We're speaking with Gary Ruskin, who's with the Congressional Accountability Project in Washington, D.C. They, too, are putting out a statement today, as Congress members have been doing throughout the weekend since the House subcommittee released their report on Saturday morning. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. ¶¶ You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're continuing to talk to Gary Ruskin, director of the Congressional Accountability Project, about Speaker Gingrich admitting the violations of House ethics rules and what this all means. Gary, can you tell us who is on this House Ethics Subcommittee?
Sure. It's composed of four members of the House Ethics Committee, and those, the chairman is Porter Goss. The ranking Democratic member is Ben Cardin. The two other members are Stephen Schiff and Nancy Pelosi. And then not on the committee, but assisting the committee, is Special Counsel James Cole.
And who is Goss?
Porter Goss, former CIA agent, a very rock-ribbed conservative Republican who has very close ties to, ironically, to the founder of GOPEC, P. DuPont.
What are those ties?
Well, he's either the godson or the great godson. I can't remember which one it is.
Of DuPont.
Of DuPont.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think? What's your assessment of what this subcommittee found? You've been following Gingrich for a long time, of laying out what you have thought are the violations that he has committed. Do you think that they went easy on him?
Well, I think that the special counsel certainly did a fine job in unearthing a series of false or misleading statements by the speaker, and in that respect, they did a good job, and so that was quite thoroughly done.
Can you explain the distinction that Republicans are making, like Susan Molinari, Republican of New York, and her husband Bill Paxon of upstate New York, when they gave their press conferences? They repeatedly said that Bonnier is wrong, that the committee called Gingrich a liar.
Well, you know, the committee did not use the word liar, so you know, technically they are correct in that matter. But the bottom line here is that there is this very long list of statements that were made by the speaker through counsel that are plainly not true. And you know, let's just pick one of them and explain how absolutely false it is. You know, to just quote one, GOPAC had absolutely no role in funding, promoting, or administering Renewing American Civilization, which was the college course. Now, you know, some basic facts here. GOPAC employees on GOPAC time using GOPAC donor lists helped raise tax-exempt money to finance the Gingrich course. GOPAC employees on GOPAC time helped arrange satellite transmission for the course. GOPAC employees worked with officials at the Kennesaw State College to plan the Gingrich course. I mean, through and through, this was a GOPAC-assisted, affiliated course, and this is at the core of the matter before the investigative subcommittee. Statement is plainly not true, and that's why Congressman Bonnier calls this lies, and I think he has a fair case to make that these were, some of them were in fact lies. Yes.
Is this such a big deal? I mean, do people really care? Should we care about this?
Well, I think there are a long list of reasons why people should care about this. First of all, you know, the speaker has been repeatedly criticized by the Ethics Committee in the past. I mean, he's got a rap sheet that is really long on ethics matters. And we can go through some of those other charges where the speaker has been found to have violated House rules or committed other blameworthy conduct. So that's one reason. The guy is a repeat offender. Second is just the sheer cynicism of his actions is absolutely breathtaking. For example, Speaker Gingrich used something called the Abraham Lincoln Opportunity Foundation for partisan political activity. Now, what was the Abraham Lincoln Opportunity Foundation? It was established, it's a nonprofit established to help inner-city youth. Now, instead, Speaker Gingrich used this foundation to produce and broadcast something called American Citizens Television, which was partisan political television programming. And the use of a nonprofit chartered for a noble purpose to do, you know, partisan political programming is absolutely reprehensible. Furthermore, some of this has to do with an offense against the taxpayers, in that the speaker built the federal government of tax monies that should have gone to the United States Treasury. Basically, by conducting all these political activities with tax-exempt monies, tax monies that should have gone to the Treasury did not go to the Treasury. That is, I believe, an offense against the taxpayers, and I think that the taxpayers will be quite mad when they figure this out.
Now, we saw a lot of Republicans going to bat for Newt Gingrich this weekend, and they do say that they will be reelecting him as Speaker of the House on January 7th when they have that election. But one of the points that Bonnier makes is that a lot of these people benefited from what Gingrich did, from these violations. In what way?
Well, the main idea behind GOPAC was to set up an outside movement outside the Republican Party that could help the Republican Party gain control of the Congress, which it in fact did precisely the way the Speaker wanted it to. And that's how the Speaker actually got to be elected Speaker, because of this GOPAC effort. And so many members of Congress who are now members of Congress have tremendously benefited from GOPAC and are members of Congress because of GOPAC and are in the majority in the Congress because of GOPAC. And so they have benefited, yes.
Gary Ruskin, what about what happened early on Saturday morning? Now, it's very uncharacteristic for the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, not to speak, but he hasn't been speaking since the committee released its report. But I understand that there was an extended meeting that this House subcommittee had with Newt Gingrich, a kind of negotiation that took place until they reached their conclusions in this report.
Yeah, we know very little about that, and that will be something that I hope reporters will be asking about in the coming days to find out what was the nature of that negotiation.
Why would the Speaker be in a position to negotiate? Why wouldn't this House subcommittee simply release their report? Was it that they were going to decide whether to propose that the House go to a full hearing, and it was there that Gingrich said, okay, he'll sign off on this and say that the findings are true?
Well, the House is the House probably will go to a full proceeding later on, either in the year or at the beginning of next year, as the full Ethics Committee will as well. Precisely what was happening at that negotiation between with the Speaker is just unclear. It's hard for me to comment on it. But it may have had some of the characteristics of a plea bargain, but it's hard to say.
So what we're going to see right now is an election on January 7th, and you predict that Newt Gingrich will be reelected?
I predict that he won't be reelected, no.
That he will not be reelected?
He will not be reelected.
Well, you're different from most of the pundits on television. What do you think will happen?
Well, I think that it's just going to require a few days for people to read what these charges are and understand the severity of them and the long list of violations of House rules previously committed by the Speaker and other blameworthy conduct. And I think when people understand the full picture here, that they won't stand for having the Speaker reelected as Speaker.
And what do you expect the House, the full House Ethics Committee, will recommend in Gingrich's case?
Well, I think they'll recommend censure, which would require that the Speaker would be forced from the Speaker's chair.
Now, we only have a minute to go, but ethics violations are not unique to the House Speaker. We've been hearing a lot about President Clinton and his fundraising activities amongst people like the Riotti family, the Indonesian moguls. What do we expect to see in Congress in the next few weeks around Clinton? And do you think that we're going to find some serious real ethics violations and financial violations and breaking of the law there?
Well, it's hard to say, but certainly there have been some very ominous developments for the president, and if you're asking me, some very good developments in that the Justice Department has now sought a number of records relating to a number of Democratic Party fundraisers and donors, including Charlie Tree and John Wang and James and Mukhtar Riotti, and who were former employees of the Lippo Group. And so this Justice Department investigation is ongoing. There are real possibilities of violations of federal law here. I think it's too early really to know what will come of this, but certainly we hope that the full and thorough investigations are done by both the House and the Senate into these serious matters.
Well, Gary Ruskin, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and we'll certainly be back with you as we see what unfolds in Congress. Gary Ruskin is director of the Congressional Accountability Project based in Washington, D.C. And you're listening to Democracy Now! As we switch gears almost entirely right now to talk about families and communities gathering together in this holiday season and what's in store. One of the things is tonight on PBS, a documentary is going to be aired called Not in Our Town, about courageous people who joined together to take a stand against hate crimes in 1996.
Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wear?
We work together, go to school together. We share values and dreams for our children's futures. We share this country. But there are divisions that tear at the soul of who we are as a nation.
Racism's a problem of the heart, and the way you attack racism is on the community level.
When ordinary citizens take a stand against hate and intolerance, it can send a powerful message of hope to the whole country.
I just thought it was wrong, and it was un-American, and I wanted to make it right somehow.
People, they're kind of scared to talk about racism because they want to ignore it, and they say, okay, if we don't talk about it, it won't happen. But that's not the way to solve the problem.
I think everybody wants to come together, but what I think people are afraid.
If you don't take some kind of action to prevent what has happened in the past, it will repeat itself. But we're committed to it not happening in our time.
In the next hour, you'll meet people across America who decided it's too dangerous to sit on the sidelines when hate comes to town. This is Billings, Montana. One winter a few years ago, the people here found some simple ways to draw together by taking a stand against hate and intolerance. We told their story in a PBS special called Not in Our Town. Their actions inspired communities all over the country to do the same. When hate happens, or someone is attacked, or a church is burned, respond. Hate crimes happen every day in this country, but they're often ignored. People of Billings, Montana decided not to look the other way. And here's what they did that inspired other communities to do the same. When a Native American family's home was defaced with racist graffiti, 30 members of the Painters Union showed up to paint over it.
So many of the times, there's a cause and I end up standing on the sidelines too much. I would feel something, but I never really did a lot to do anything about anything. And I was really glad to help paint the house, and more so, to help convey a message to these guys that the community will not stand for that.
When services at an African-American church were disrupted by skinheads, members of other religious denominations from throughout Billings attended to help secure the church.
Denomination didn't count. Ethnic background didn't count. Color of skin didn't count. It was just that we were one people in the all together as one. And they did rally around, let them know, hey, if you bite one, you bite us all.
Billings Police Chief Wayne Inman took a strong stand against the hate crimes and became actively involved in the community's response.
If a police chief doesn't take a visible and active role, then there's an assumption that everything is all right. And these hate groups have learned through experience that if a community doesn't respond, then the community accepts. Silence is acceptance to them.
Hate flyers were posted near the synagogue, and the Jewish cemetery was desecrated. Then, a brick was thrown through the bedroom window of a 6-year-old boy who had placed a menorah there for Hanukkah.
I remember discussing it with the publisher of the Gazette the next morning after this had happened and saying that please make this front page news because I want people to understand what it's like to be Jewish.
I guess it was a question of looking for an image that kind of put this together. During the Second World War, the Danish king is reputed to have come out after the Jewish community there was forced to wear stars by the Nazi occupiers, that he was reported to have come out with a yellow star, too.
The Billings Gazette printed a full-page menorah for townspeople to tear out and hang in their windows.
The good thing about this town is that everybody said that one day, let's get together. So what we're going to do is put menorahs in our windows, and pretty soon everybody we knew had one.
By late December, nearly 10,000 people in Billings, Montana had menorahs in their windows.
I would like to have thought that if this had happened to my Native American community, that they would have put a Native American symbol in their window. If it happened to the gay and lesbian community, that they would have put a pink triangle in their window. I would have liked to have hoped or think that they would have done that.
These simple acts of ordinary people in Billings, Montana, standing up for their neighbors, inspired others around the country to do something in their communities.
And that is an excerpt of the documentary that will air tonight called Not in Our Town, a moving testament to the power of grassroots activism in the fight against racism, sexism, homophobia, and violence, airing tonight on public television stations around the country. And right now we're joined by Patrice O'Neill, who is executive producer of Not in Our Town. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Patrice.
Good morning, Amy.
Why don't you tell us about how this all started? Because tonight's airing is not the first time Not in Our Town has been seen.
Actually, the program is called Not in Our Town 2, and we thought it was an appropriate program for the holiday season. But if you watch it, you have to let go of your cynicism. And I think when you meet some of the people in the story, like the people in Billings, you'll want to let go because there's simple acts against racism. Have a powerful impact. What happened is we did the program Not in Our Town. It aired as a PBS special last year, which is the Billings story. And people heard about that and organized town hall meetings around the country. We thought initially there would be maybe 10 in 10 cities and that we could help spark that. What happened is there were hundreds of town hall meetings in schools, in libraries, in union halls, in workplaces, and people saw what happened in Billings and said, how can we have this happen in our community? It was a very inspiring campaign overall. But then last June, we got a phone call from people in Bloomington, Illinois, and they said, we want to order 2,000 Not in Our Town buttons. And we said, well, we're a media company. We did that campaign last year. There were buttons that went with the campaign that said Not in Our Town that people wore. But we don't really have any buttons. And they said, well, our community saw Not in Our Town, and we want to respond to the church burnings across the country. We are very concerned that this is happening in the South. We want to make sure it doesn't happen here. We're going to have a march from the courthouse to one of the black churches in town, and we need 2,000 buttons to accompany that. And we thought, wow, they're really taking this seriously. And Bloomington really was the spark for us to go back to some of those communities that had used Not in Our Town and find out what had happened there.
In just a minute, we're going to go to a police chief in California who is one of those who wears those buttons. And I should say that we're talking to Patrice O'Neill in Berkeley, California. We're going to hear about a story from another part of California that really took inspiration from what happened in Billings, Montana. And then we're going to go south to South Carolina to look at the church burnings this year and what people did, how they rallied around black churches that were burned. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Thank you.
Imagine doing something as simple as going grocery shopping and nearly being killed just because of how you look. That's what happened here in Novato, California. But fortunately, people in this town reacted immediately. Novato is a suburban community 30 miles north of San Francisco. It's not a place that's accustomed to dealing with hate violence, but it can happen anywhere. It was an early afternoon in November. A young computer programmer was walking into a suburban grocery store in Novato.
I thought it was two kids fighting at first, until I saw the knife come around.
And suddenly he was attacked by a man with a large hunting knife.
He grabbed him on the shoulder and stuck it in his back.
25-year-old Eddie Wu was stabbed four times by his attacker. But the employees and other customers at this lucky grocery store did not just look on. Two store clerks, Chris Baker and Fred Martin, chased after the attacker, who threatened them with his knife. But they managed to stay with him until they were able to flag down the police. Other store employees tried to stop Eddie Wu from bleeding until the paramedics arrived.
He was in front of the time clock on the floor in a puddle of his own blood.
Eddie Wu was rushed to the hospital, where he spent several weeks in critical condition. After the attacker was arrested, the police quickly determined that the attempted murder on Eddie Wu was a racially motivated hate crime.
And that, another excerpt from Not in Our Town 2, the documentary that's airing on PBS tonight. And joining us right now is Brian Brady, chief of police in Novato, California, who's made police response to hate crimes a high priority. Welcome to Democracy Now! You're joining Patrice O'Neill, executive producer of Not in Our Town 2.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Can you tell us what it is that you did after Eddie Wu, the Chinese-American computer analyst, was stabbed four times and you found the assailant?
Basically, what we've done, our policy involves using command officers, and as a terminology, those are people the ranks of lieutenant or above in the department, to do follow-up with victims on hate crimes. And the rationale behind this is that we want the victims to understand that it is a high priority. It's something that will not be tolerated. It's something the department puts the top-level people to follow up on, to see to it that the individuals are recovering from it, to see to it that there's no reoccurrence. So not only will they be recontacted by the investigating officers, there's also follow-up by the top brass, so to speak, in the department to reassure individuals that this is an isolated incident, not something that was going to happen again.
Now, something that I saw in Not in Our Town 2 about your story is this approach you take to dealing with the victims as well, assigning a police officer, for example, to Eddie Wu and bringing them into the process.
Yes, that worked out exceptionally well. We've done it since then on a couple of other incidents that were not nearly the magnitude of Eddie Wu's case. And the officer, who happened to be a captain in this case, and Eddie actually became very good friends. At one point, Eddie's family was very concerned that this was something that could happen again. They even suggested at one point that he might consider moving. And I'm very pleased to say he still lives in our community. He didn't. The family's convinced that this was an isolated incident, and he's still a very active member in the community.
Had you heard about the Billings, Montana case?
Yes, we had. As a matter of fact, I was aware of it. We had seen the tape when it came out, and our mayor at that time, being November, elections changed. The mayor, who was mayor when it happened, and the city manager both went to the hospital to see Eddie when it happened, too. It wasn't just a police follow-up. It was a community, a citywide outreach. Then the new mayor, Ernie Gray, decided that he wanted to use the Not in Our Town tape as a focal point for a town meeting and to present awards to the employees from the Lucky Store and who had chased the suspect, identified him, those who had given first aid to Eddie. And as a consequence, he went one step further and put together a multicultural oversight committee that myself, one of the members of the community, who's the chair of the Marin County Human Rights Commission, and the mayor were the steering committee for that. And we're doing another town forum this January, when we'll use Not in Our Town 2 as the focal point for that meeting to keep this as an ongoing part of the community.
So the assailant, the one who was caught by the store clerks, the man who later confessed that he planned to, quote, go kill me a Chinaman because he thought that this person, he felt that an Asian had replaced him in a job. How did, whatever happened ultimately to him?
He is currently in state prison. The individual plea bargained to some degree. The district attorney's office was not ready to let him plea bargain to anything less than the major assault case. So he's currently in state prison. He's facing a minimum of 8 years to a maximum of 13 years.
Patrice O'Neill, how did this story of this community dealing with the stabbing of Eddie Wu fit into this second series, that you, the second show that you're doing, Not in Our Town 2?
Well, Brian's modest about this, but we wanted to highlight again, as we did with Wayne Inman, who was the police chief in Billings, Montana, the role of law enforcement working with their community. And Brian, as many other police officers who are using community policing, had a set of priorities for how to deal with hate crimes, and we wanted to highlight that. We wanted to show that, but we also wanted to show that community, people surrounding a hate crime, need to respond immediately, and that's what happened in Novato.
Brian Brady, let me ask you this as chief of police. Here in New York, and I know in Los Angeles, and certainly in a number of big cities, what a lot of communities, particularly communities of color, consider who they consider the greatest perpetrators of hate crimes are often the police. In New York City, we have a number of situations this year where people were attacked and, in fact, a number of people died in police custody. And it was usually white cops and African-Americans or Latinos in their hands. How do you deal with this issue?
You know, it's a very difficult issue. There has to be a breakdown of barriers that have existed. There are, as you say, people of color who have been disenfranchised from the system. There has to be an outreach, and it has to come from us, us being the police. We currently are the power broker. We currently have the majority of the power. And somehow or other, we have to reach out to the community. In our particular case, community policing has a number of different facets. What we decided to do was to spend a year in the community before we, quote, implemented community policing. In that year, we asked officers to join community groups. So currently, we have officers that sit on actually the boards of directors as well as other key positions with our Human Needs Center, our Youth Center, with African-American groups, with Latino groups. And at the end of a year, we went and talked with each of the boards of directors to find out, now that they had a trust level built up with this particular officer in the department, what their major concerns were, what they wanted from us. And then we tried to tailor the response of the department to meet the concerns being expressed by the community. In doing so, I really think you knock down a lot of walls, because you are now empowering people who before didn't have access to that power base. Now they're making some determinations as to how the organization is going to function and what the priority should be. And as it's a listening situation. It's spending some extra time there. It's giving people the opportunity to vocalize their concerns and then responding to them.
Well, I wanted to turn now to another story, because there are a number of extremely inspirational stories in Not in Our Town 2 inspired by the Billings, Montana case. And this one revolves around, in fact, there were a few of them that revolve around church burnings in the South.
During the early days of the 1960s civil rights movement, the nation was shocked when the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, was firebombed by a Ku Klux Klan member. Four young girls were killed. While people across the nation mourned these children, churches continued to burn throughout the South. A year later, Martin Luther King spoke at the site of this burned church in Mississippi.
Share the sorrow of many people over this kind of tragedy, and it reveals the low depths of man's inhumanity to man and the barbaric tendencies still alive in our society.
Despite continued attacks on African-American churches throughout this nation's history, they have thrived as spiritual and community centers.
At the end of the old state road in Dixiana, South Carolina, is the site of one of the oldest churches in the country. It was established in 1765 and first burned to the ground by the British. Today, this is all that remains of St. John Baptist Church after being burned down again in 1995.
So when we build a new church, we're going to put the cornerstone back.
And that was the deacon of the church in South Carolina that was burned. Can you tell us about this story, Patrice O'Neill? Again, Patrice O'Neill, executive producer of Not in Our Town 2, where this excerpt came from.
Well, I think certainly when I look back on this year, I think the church burnings was one of the major stories this year. And the controversy about the media coverage, did the media cover it too much? Were they being alarmist? And what we found in Not in Our Town, too, were people who were frankly very alarmed, reporters, community members, firefighters, other churches who were very alarmed at churches that were burned because of hate. And we went out not to tell the story necessarily of the church burnings, but the very inspirational response. One of the people that has been with St. John Church for a very long time is a woman named Amy Murray. She was an organizer for the Laborers Union, but she had a friend named Barbara Sammons, who was the wife of Willie Sammons, the deacon of St. John Church, who told her in 1985 that her church had been attacked. The church had been attacked by a white supremacist group and nearly destroyed. At that time, Amy drew on the community around Columbia, South Carolina, and they helped rebuild St. John Baptist Church, only to have it burned down again in the series of church burnings in 1995. Amy is still very much involved with that congregation, and her story was told by Bob Herbert in the New York Times, and a firefighter in New York City saw it and was so inspired by it that he sent down to Amy and the congregation 100 Bibles engraved with St. John Baptist Church. We met Pete. He's part of the program, and I think he's an inspiring kind of person, someone out there like many people who hear about the racial division and the tragedy of the church burning and say, I want to do something. And I think that's how the Billings story inspired people. People just took small steps and said, I want to do something. I see all this stuff going on out there, and I want to do something.
There was also a white church just down the road from St. John's Church, and they were somewhat afraid to reach out to the black church. As they said, they were afraid that people would feel, we already have been hurt by white people. We don't need your help. But in fact, in the end, they did come together.
They came together, and I think that's a very inspiring story, a very different church. One of the neighbors said, well, there's a black church on this end of the road, and there's a white church here, and no one's ever touched the white church, and this church has been burned and attacked for many years. And the deacon in the Baptist church down the road gathered up people, other deacons, other activists in his church, and they went down, and they're actually helping to rebuild St. John Church. And I thought it was a really honest answer. He said, we were afraid, and I think that's part of the division. Several people said that to us. We're afraid. We're afraid to come together. We're afraid of the barriers and the anger that exists. And I think that's real. I think there is that anger, but you know, taking those steps and taking those risks really made a difference.
Moving north and west up to Oregon, a very powerful story in your documentary in Medford, Oregon, about community meetings that were held to raise awareness about the growing threat of hate activities after a lesbian couple was murdered by a man who admits it was a hate crime.
In Medford last year, as we were putting together the Not in Our Town campaign, two women, very popular businesswomen in Medford, were murdered. They were missing for a long time. They finally found them. They were murdered, and the man who killed them admitted to a newspaper reporter that he killed them because they were lesbians. I think this really shocked this community. Oregon's a place where there's a lot of kind of white supremacist militia activity, and this shocked this community. And since that time, there's been a series of meetings to really talk about how Medford can prevent this from happening again. I think one of the pieces I find most inspiring in there is a teacher in a junior high school class who's trying to talk to her students about prejudice and what it means, and if the children had seen prejudice happen, and they were talking about some kids chasing after a gay man, and this was a real life experience to them. But somehow they were able to talk about it in school, and I think that's really a place where kids learn things like this and or can unlearn them.
We only have just a minute, but I did want to ask Brian Brady, a police chief of Novato, California, about this issue again of how you train police to deal with issues of hate crimes and sensitivity. I know when national gay and lesbian groups come out with the incidents of violence against gays and lesbians, one of the things that they often talk about is the lack of sensitivity of police to crimes against gays and lesbians.
I think what you have to do is you have to have a clear policy in your organization that you're going to respond, you're going to respond quickly, you're not going to re-victimize the victim. By that I mean that when someone makes the report, you're going to take it at face value. You're not going to try and discredit the report. In the course of the investigation, you may ultimately discover that the motivating factor may not have been a hate crime. It may have been something totally different, but you take it as a hate crime initially. We're doing better as far as reporting. California now is asking and mandating reporting from all agencies, and their numbers should become pretty accurate very shortly. Federal government's trying to gather the same information. It's on a voluntary basis with the federal government, but they're getting much greater compliance. So I think in the next couple of years, we'll get a much better handle on how widespread this truly is. But to make the community feel safe and secure, it has to come from the top of the organization to make it clear that that's the priority, have clear policies, and then train your individuals to respect the diversity in the community and to respond to it.
Well, Police Chief Brian Brady, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And I want to ask Patrice O'Neill, executive producer of Not in Our Town 2, how people can get in touch with your organization if they want to get those buttons, if they want to find out more about communities that are organizing around the country against hate.
You can call our office at 510-547-8484. Again, we're a media.
Give that number again.
510-547-8484.
I also see that you have a homepage, Not in Our Town. That's www.igc.org/an/niot.html. And we don't have time to repeat it, just very quickly, igc.org/an/niot.html if people want to get in touch with Not in Our Town. If you'd like to get a copy of this show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with help from Errol Maitland and Dan Coughlin. And we want to thank you very much for listening to Democracy Now! Patrice O'Neill, thanks for being with us. Read My